Good morning. You are listening to Raven Radio. Today is Wednesday, November 21st, 2012. I'm Holly Keene, and this is Raven News. The phone book lists him as Gilbert Truitt, and that's probably how he gets his mail and pays his bills. But to everyone else, he is known as Mr. Mount Edgecombe. Gil Truitt spent 34 years at Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka as a teacher, coach, and principal, 36 if you count his 2 years as a student. In celebration of Native American Heritage Month, Truitt spoke to the Sitka Rotary Club this week about the history of the state-run boarding school, some of it the kind of history you can read about in the library, and some of it much more personal. KCAW's Robert Woolsey attended and filed this report.
Truitt was born and raised in Sitka, but began his education at the now-defunct Wrangell Institute. In fact, he recalls the day when he was boarding a seine boat in the Wrangell Harbor with the rest of his basketball team for a trip to Prince of Wales Island, when they saw three cars driving quickly down the highway toward them in a cloud of dust. It was the superintendent of the Wrangell Institute who told them that their school was closing and that they were being sent immediately to a new school in Sitka.
Well, he was talking, the first plane landed, and seven boys who had come down in those three vehicles were put on the plane. They took off, and we were right behind them. 1 hour after we got here, February 22nd, 1947, every basketball team in Sitka came over and challenged us through basketball.
That was the day Gil Truitt arrived at Mount Edgecombe, and except for his college studies and master's degree work, he never left, not even after his official retirement in 1991. Truitt told the Sitka Rotary that the success of the Mount Edgecombe alumni spoke to the success of the school, which was founded in the post-war era on discipline, courtesy, and respect. He also took pains to defend the boarding school culture at the Wrangell Institute, Mount Edgecombe, and Sheldon Jackson, which he said focused on preparing students for the future and was not about suppressing Native culture.
At no time were we ever told, do not speak your language. Never.
Truitt says Native culture and art classes were available in his boarding school education.
These were not popular classes or courses, because students at those schools were there for a purpose, just as they are at Mount Edgecombe today for a purpose. They want the best education possible, so they fill up their class schedule with courses that they know will eventually help them when they leave Mount Edgecombe.
Mount Edgecombe was opened by the Bureau of Indian Affairs in 1947 and graduated its first class, including Truitt, the following year. Truitt says that was the beginning of a golden era at the school, but it was not to last. The BIA eventually decided to close Mount Edgecombe in 1982. Truitt says an unlikely hero helped keep the school alive.
We had a man running for the United States Senate. He said, if I am elected, I will do whatever I can to reopen the school when it closes. And he pulled out a letter. It was from a student pleading with him to help. It was Senator Frank Murkowski was the individual. We tried to talk to other politicians, but they wouldn't listen. He was the only one who sat down and talked to the student body. He kept his word.
Even when the BIA did shutter the school in 1983, Truitt says he knew it wouldn't be closed for long.
And when the school closed, it was very sad. But I was not one of those who was sad, because I felt that the school is too good to keep closed. But also, I knew we had that huge alumni statewide, and they flooded the state legislators with letters to reopen the school. It reopened September 30th, 1985.
During questions and answers, Truitt alluded to, but did not directly comment on, tensions between the community of Sitka and Mount Edgecombe while it was in the hands of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. He simply referred to 1985 as the beginning of a new era, one that he has positive feelings for.
And I think the community learned how important economically to this community is that school. But it's totally different today. And I appreciate what I see. I appreciate the two schools doing things together and getting along much better than in the past.
Truitt says Mount Edgecombe may be due for another reunion. The last one was in 1997 on the 50th anniversary of the school. Over 600 alums turned out. Housing them all was a challenge. Truitt used the occasion to survey alums about their Mount Edgecombe experience. He reports that the family spirit of the school remains a strong memory right behind dorm life and basketball. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Today at 8:18, Raven News will air the last segment in our three-part interview with Lieutenant Lance Leone. The Coast Guard aviator survived a 2010 helicopter crash in which three others from Air Station Sitka died. Yesterday, Leone described the crash and his rescue.
I was in the left seat, and my shoulders and my knees and my head were just all banging around in the cabin for I don't know how long. It felt very slow motion. But then there was a rapid stop, and that rapid stop quickly became a rapid liquid stop, and I was underwater, upside down, in a helicopter.
It happened that fast?
It was that fast. We were flying, everything was fine, and then it blew apart when I was underwater, I didn't know any. It felt like the world was shaking apart.
What did it sound like?
Screeching and cracking. I had double hearing protection, but it was kind of like a pounding and the screeching. I got to actually listen to it on the voice recorder, and it is literally screeching and crashing. I don't know how to link it to what anyone else would hear. I guess like a car accident.
Was that difficult, listening to those recordings?
Well, I had the opportunity to read the recordings months in advance. Actually, this time last year was the first time that I had the ability to read through the recording and to go through and see what I had done right. I'd read the investigation and seen everything that I had done wrong and what the crew had done wrong, because that's what they focused on. But to see what I had done right and everything that I did to the best of my ability, but then to listen to it and hear the sounds, it was, I would say, troubling. But I was ready for it based upon my desire. I didn't have to. My lawyers could have just listened to it with me outside of the room. But I wanted to make sure that the nonverbals made it into there.
Leone's talking about nonverbal communication inside the cockpit. He wanted to make sure it became part of the accident investigation. We've posted the full segment on our website, kcaw.org, along with part one of the conversation, which aired Monday. This morning, Leone talks about his recovery from the accident.
It was very difficult mentally, because obviously all I wanted to do was curl up into a ball and cry that Sean specifically wasn't there anymore. I'd known him since I showed up at the academy.
Part three in the Lance Leone interview airs at 8:18 a.m. You can also find it online at kcaw.org. Scientists want to know how rapidly melting glaciers are affecting marine life in southeast Alaska waters. They're concerned all that fresh water is making the ocean more acidic. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld spoke with one of the experts in the field at this month's Sitka Whale Fest Science Symposium. He filed this report.
Scientists have known for years that greenhouse gases are altering the chemical makeup of our oceans. More and more carbon dioxide is dissolving into salt water, creating carbonic acid. That changes the ocean's pH, or acid-alkaline balance. And it's hitting harder in Alaska.
We really have a very unique environment that's preconditioned to already be sensitive to ocean acidification.
That's Jeremy Mathis, who directs the University of Alaska Fairbanks Ocean Acidification Research Center. He's also an oceanographer with NOAA's Pacific Marine Environmental Lab in Seattle.
Then as more and more carbon dioxide is added into that environment, it pushes past a threshold where the waters can actually become corrosive.
While northern waters are of particular risk, scientists are trying to get a better handle on timing and location. That's why Mathis is researching changes in the waters of Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve.
glacier runoff, glacier meltwater, has very low carbonate minerals, these minerals that the organisms are using to build their shells. And so if you dilute the surface water, if you melt a whole bunch of glaciers, all that water flows off the land and into the ocean.
The bay, in northern southeast, was chosen because it's a productive marine environment undergoing rapid change. The three-year project has two more years to go.
We go out and we collect hundreds of water samples every month up and down the bay. We stop every few miles and we make these observations from the surface all the way to the bottom. And over time, we can slowly start to see the different impacts.
Mathis says what's found in Glacier Bay will apply to other glaciated coastal areas. Research has already shown how rapid melting and warming waters are changing the Arctic. Corrosive, acidic water can hurt shellfish the most. The degree of damage depends on the species, how it develops, and how deep it lives. An oft-told example is a major die-off of tiny oysters, called spat, in Oregon and Washington nurseries and shellfish farms.
They finally realized what was going on is upwelling conditions along the coast and the intrusion of that anthropogenic CO2 into the water had pushed the water to a point to where when they mixed it in and brought it into their facilities, they were literally dissolving out their oyster spat.
Operators solved the problem by shutting off pipes, bringing in seawater when upwellings made it too acidic. They recycled what was already in their systems until the water reached safer levels. Mathis says that's not a long-term solution. Ocean acidification will reach a point where it can't be avoided.
We see those same conditions in the water here in the Gulf of Alaska that they see down to our south off the west coast. And in fact, it's probably a little bit worse up here.
That could damage Alaska's growing oyster industry, with farms from South Central's Homer to Southeast's Prince of Wales Island. Mathis says there's no evidence yet that ocean acidification hurts development of fish or marine mammal skeletons.
And that's all for Raven News. You are listening to KCAW Sitka.